You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am here with an update on the Vicky White and Casey Cole White case. In the previous episode this past Monday, I left off with them being on the run. Of course, as fate would have it, I released that episode in the morning, and then later that afternoon, they were found. So we are going to cover everything that we know right now, as well as some other big cases in the news and updates. We have Orsulia Gall and some other tragic cases circulating in the media right now. But first, let's go ahead and get our housekeeping out of the way. Again, you're listening to We Saw the Devil. I'm your host, Robin. Our website is WeSawTheDevil.com. From there, you can find us across all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is WeSawTheDevil across all of them. If you're loving the show and digging it, check out our Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you can financially back the show, become part of the team, and get some cool stuff in return. Also, if you're loving the show, please don't hesitate to, on whichever platform you're currently listening on, to take 10 seconds and drop that 5-star review. It's incredibly powerful. It means the world to us, but it's also really important with a variety of administration pieces of podcasting as well. So we will love you forever, and you'll also be helping out a show that you support. Alrighty, let's go ahead and get into it. Obviously, we're going to begin with the Vicky White and Casey Cole White news. For those of you who have absolutely no idea which case I'm talking about, here is your 10-second recap. Vicky White was a veteran correctional officer literally 3 days from retirement. She had also apparently fallen in love with an inmate at the jail where she worked named Casey White, no relation. Casey White was serving 75 years in prison for crimes he committed in 2015. Those included a home invasion, kidnapping, carjacking, animal cruelty, and more. After confessing to stabbing 59-year-old Connie Ridgeway in 2015 as well, he also now faces 2 charges of capital murder, on top of whatever charges he'll receive from this little romantic escapade. Vicky White sold her house for dirt cheap, bought a getaway car, helped Casey White escape, and then they have been on the run for the past 11 days, and that is where the last episode left off. Well, we have a lot more information now. What was the final day like? How did it culminate in this? How were they caught? I mean, Casey White is a hulking 6'9". He's kind of hard to miss. A man that tall, traveling with a short, stocky older woman, bound to turn heads, and that's what happened. Law enforcement received a tip this past Sunday night that a 2006 Ford F-150 had been discovered at a car wash in Evansville, Indiana. Now, don't forget, the pair had had the 2007 orange Ford Edge, and they had been traveling in that, and it was found abandoned in Williamson County, Tennessee, literally 20 minutes from my house. The owner of the car wash where the F-150, the one in Indiana, had it towed. And it took 2 days for officials to figure out that it had been purchased by Vicky and Casey White for $6,000 in Tennessee on the day of the escape. They took off from the jail in Vicky's cop car, made it to the shopping center parking lot, switched over into the orange Ford Edge, made it to Williamson County, Tennessee. I've seen some officials say that they must have had mechanical issues on that car that led them to abandoning it. Somehow in Tennessee, they spent $6,000 on this Ford F-150 and then promptly drove to Indiana, ending up in Evansville. So officers followed up on this lead, and the owner of the car wash provided them with CCTV footage. In that footage, you can see Casey White exiting that Ford F-150, walking across the parking lot, and getting into a gray Cadillac sedan. So after some digging, they actually located that Cadillac and discovered that Vicky and Casey White were staying at the Motel 41 in Evansville, Indiana, roughly 300 miles from their original location in Florence, Alabama. And they had actually been there since May 3rd. Casey and Vicky did in fact try to get a room for themselves, but couldn't because neither one of them had any identification on them. They obviously weren't handing out their IDs like candy. Investigating officers said that it seems as though a third person may have helped them book that room. That's going to be very interesting as that person has not yet been identified. The room had been paid for 14 days, for 2 weeks, and they had already been there for 1 week. Apparently, per Casey White's post-arrest interview, their plan was to stay there for 2 weeks because they thought they were far enough away from Alabama. He thought that they could take some time, get their bearings, and figure out the next place to go. Well, a tip came in and U.S. Marshals began surveillance on that motel. On Monday, they saw Casey and Vicky leave the room. They decided to follow, and pretty quickly, a car pursuit ended up taking place. At this time, Vicky White dialed 911 and was on the phone with the dispatch center. She allegedly told the 911 operator that she had a gun and her finger was on the trigger. The car pursuit took place over almost 2 full miles, and towards the end of it, a U.S. Marshals Task Force member pulled up, bumped the Cadillac that Casey White was driving, and it ended up crashing in a ditch and rolling over. Responding officers were able to pull Casey White out of the car. He only sustained minor injuries. Now, as they were doing this, Casey said, "Help my wife," and "I didn't do it." Do what, you may ask? Well, Vicky White was pinned inside, unresponsive, and had just attempted suicide by shooting herself in the head. Officers reported that she still had possession of the handgun and that it had just freshly been discharged. And if you head over to our Facebook page, I actually posted the video that officers released showing them pulling her from the wreckage and attempting CPR. An ambulance came, but Vicky White died shortly thereafter at the hospital. It was also reported that Casey White showed absolutely zero remorse for her death whatsoever. Inside of that Cadillac, police found $29,000 in cash, wigs, 4 semi-automatic handguns, and an AR-15 rifle. In a post-arrest interview with Casey White, he also told them that they had planned to have a shootout with police and died that way if it had to come to that point. In an appearance yesterday morning at the Vandenberg County Jail, Casey White waived his right to an extradition hearing, telling the judge, quote, "I'm waiving my rights. I'm going back to Alabama." And he was apparently moved to Alabama later that evening in total secrecy. They just didn't want that media circus. Also, in an ironic twist, it became known that Vicky White herself was actually nominated as the Corrections Employee of the Year for Lauderdale County. The fact that she was nominated is now known, and ironically, the award ceremony is actually slated for next week. And that's what's been so bizarre about absolutely all of this. Vicky White had already won Employee of the Year 4 times during her, by all accounts, exemplary tenure as a corrections officer. She was that well respected and loved by her peers. There are so many questions that remain, like why did Vicky White choose to throw her money, retirement, pension, freedom, and apparently life away for an alleged murderer who was never going to see the light of day? And at least for me, I think that's the main question. It's one thing for a woman to contact a killer in prison. I think in the previous episode, I mentioned how women frequently wrote to Jeffrey Dahmer barking up the wrong tree, even Charles Manson. They wrote them letters, sent pictures of themselves. I mean, that's gross on its own merit. But utilizing your power as the second in command of a jail to devise a plan and facilitate the escape, I mean, I have no idea. The power of loneliness cannot be overstated. Whereas you or I would never in a million years do that, or probably even write to an inmate to begin with. I mean, I don't know how many of you guys have seen Love After Lockup, but they never end well. I mean, there are clearly others who are hurting, who will, and who do this kind of thing frequently. But Vicky White's death is tragic. Casey Cole White is now back in custody. He will now face a whole host of new charges, which those haven't been listed out in an arraignment as of yet in Alabama. He's also, don't forget, up against 2 capital murder charges in the death of Connie Ridgway. And not only that, but it seems like his ex-girlfriend, who committed suicide, if you recall in the previous episode, I spoke about that very lightly. Apparently, Casey White was dating a woman. He was present at the home when she supposedly committed suicide by shooting herself in the head. Ironic, I know. And he was investigated, However, he was let go. It was in fact ruled a suicide. Well, that case now is actually being reopened by investigators to get to the bottom of it and take another look at it. So not only is Casey White going to be serving that 75-year prison sentence that he's been already convicted and sentenced to, he's also now facing two capital murder charges. And then we have this reopening of the suicide from years ago. So this is a case that I will be following closely as news happens, and you can expect more. Don't forget to subscribe if you're interested in this case. We are going to cover it in full. Moving on to another case that I covered extensively last month is the Orsolya Gall case. If you guys recall, she was the woman, married mother of two, who was stabbed by her handyman lover, stuffed into a hockey bag, and then dumped a few blocks from her home. And all of the news that just kept rapid fire coming out about that case was just absolutely horrible. And it's something that I absolutely hate about true crime and the true crime community. It's an embarrassment, really. We are reporting and discussing real human beings. And I'm sorry if I piss anyone off by saying this, but this is why I can't stand people like Nancy Grace. The sensationalizing, the names that she gives people, like Casey Anthony was Tot Mom, Lori Vallow is Cult Mom. What about the people behind these cases? This podcast was one of the first podcasts ever to start covering the Lori Vallow case. And we covered it, I mean, minute by minute, day by day. We were damn near the Lori Vallow podcast. And as the case took on a wider nationwide audience and so many people came forward and started covering it and harassing the family, it's gross. I find it gross. So Orsolya Gall's murder, I saw that same pattern of just the sensationalizing of it. A lot of victim blaming in this case, too, which was really disappointing and gross to see. Yeah, it was horribly covered. However, there is some good news that's come out in the last like 24, 48 hours. David Bonola, the man who admitted to killing her, his interviews with the police are finally seeing the light of day. And he has been incredibly forthright about what's happened and confessed to everything. There are few worse torments that I can think of than, say, my wife or mother being murdered, and then the key suspect pleading not guilty and then getting dragged into a horribly long trial. If there is any sort of ray of light in this case, is that at least he has been forthright about what he's done. And again, his interviews with police during their investigation, some snippets have finally been published. According to David Bonola, he believed that Orsolya Gall had given him HIV. He told officers at the 112th precinct on April 29th, quote, "She gave me HIV. She lied to me. She used me. She told me that she loved me. She couldn't be with one person." He also indicated that she had been cheating on him with another man. Now, as we know, on April 15th, Orsolya Gall, a married mother of two children, went out to the Lincoln Town Center with friends. She then returned to her neighborhood bar around 11:30, had her usual Moscow Mule, and from there she went home, arriving around 12:30 a.m. As we now see in CCTV stills and footage, David Bonola arrived just moments after and knocked on the door. He told investigators that Orsolya led him into the home, to the kitchen, to talk. She asked why he'd come over. He said that he just wanted to know the truth about why she had given him HIV. She immediately got flustered and denied having it. And apparently at some point, she answered a text or call from another man that she had intended to see later that morning. She told David Bonola that their affair was over, and then she grabbed a knife, telling him that he needed to leave or that she would kill him. David Bonola said that he was seeing red from her being in contact with the other man. He grabbed the knife, he slashed her neck, and then they got into a fight. He then dragged her to the basement, where he proceeded to stab her almost 50 more times. He admitted to cleaning up the house with towels and then stuffing her body into her son's hockey bag, as we saw in that CCTV footage where we see the silhouette wheeling the luggage down the street. And that is when he dropped her off at a nearby park. What about the creepy text message her husband received from the supposed killer? That was another big headline that came out when this case happened. the father says, you know, family is scared for their lives and whatnot. Well, Benola told police, quote, "In the past, she told me that she had sent a man to jail, so I sent a message to her husband pretending to be that guy because I was scared. I took her laptop because she had sex videos on the laptop. I threw her laptop in the Hudson River where I used to visit her." And like I said, he's been particularly forthcoming and matter of fact in his confession, which I don't think many of us expected. It's incredibly sad for everyone. And with this case in particular, something that I cannot get out of my head when I think of this case is her 13-year-old son. Again, her 13-year-old son was upstairs in his bedroom for most of the night, probably fell asleep at some point, and his mother was brutally murdered just beneath him. And he had no idea until police the next morning. He followed, apparently there was a quarter mile long blood trail leading to their home. Her body was discovered. They followed the blood trail, traced it back to the home, and they entered the home. And if you recall, he was still in his pajamas. And so they immediately arrested him and, well, detained him and took him into custody for questioning. And I just can't imagine how much trauma that poor child must have endured that morning. See some sort of blood evidence, learn that your beloved mother has been murdered, and then suddenly you just woke up and now you're being taken in for it. I just cannot fathom that level of trauma. But that is what we know about the case so far. And again, similar to the Vicky White and Casey Cole White case, we will be following this case as it moves through the pipeline. And here's another case to keep on your radar. I mean, my mind can't even wrap around this one. This past Sunday, on Mother's Day, Los Angeles Police Department officers were dispatched to a home on Victory Boulevard a little after 7:40 a.m. The home belonged to 38-year-old Angela Flores and four of her children. A neighbor had called in reporting that they were hearing a lot of screaming with someone saying, "Help, help, help, my family is abusing me." Once officers arrived and entered the home, they found three deceased children, 8-year-old twin boys and a 12-year-old girl. Three of Angela Flores's seven children had been dead for several hours. We do not yet know their cause of death. Angela and her 16-year-old son were both arrested and brought in for questioning, with Angela apparently being transported out on a stretcher because she was so distraught. She supposedly kept popping up and screaming, "Where's my Bible? Where's my Bible?" And that's interesting because neighbors who were later interviewed by the media after the arrest reported that Angela had frequently walked around their neighborhood, particularly on their street, lighting candles and pray screaming at houses. Thankfully, her three remaining children live out of state with their father. Both Angela and her son face three counts of murder, and Angela's bail was set at $6 million. There's no information on her underage son at this time. But this is a case that's personally on my radar. Just some of the little details that have come out about it are particularly interesting. What kind of religious fanaticism we're going to see come out of this, but horribly sad, especially on Mother's Day. And the final case that I would like to cover in this episode, it's actually a horrific ending to a case out of Alaska, but at least this ending brings closure. 38-year-old Anisha Duffy Murnane, a Homer, Alaska woman, disappeared back in October of 2019. She was walking to a mental health appointment. Anisha had been diagnosed with severe bipolar disorder and lived in a supportive living community due to not being able to live on her own. She was on medication and she seemed to be doing much better. On October 17th, she set out for that 1 mile walk down Main Street to her appointment. She had been wearing a blue jacket, blue shirt, and blue jeans. Anisha was 6 feet tall and weighed about 160 pounds with brown hair and blue eyes. Staff from the residential home called police and officially reported her missing 2 days later on the 19th. Officials issued a silver alert, and there were a lot of searches by both foot and air. So they brought in scent dogs, and scent dogs tracked her halfway down Main Street. Suddenly, the scent just vanished. And that typically indicates, especially when on a road, that the person entered a vehicle. Canine handlers call this a car pickup. Anisha Murnane was never found. Now, in Alaska, someone who has been missing for at least 5 years, 5 years or more, they are automatically presumed dead. However, the family can actually file a petition to ask for a hearing, to ask that hearing is moved up. At that hearing, the jury hears testimonies of witnesses and all legal evidence that the state currently has on that disappearance. Then they make a decision on, one, if the person is presumed dead, and two, how they may have died. So in July of 2021, her parents filed a petition to have her declared legally dead at that 2-year mark. Shockingly, at the presumptive death hearing in Homer that month, a jury determined that Anisha Murnane had died via homicide. The jury had had a host of options to pick from, but they ultimately decided to rule that she had died via homicide. And that shocked her parents. They were not expecting that. I mean, seriously, can you imagine? That's their worst fear. After Anisha had disappeared, investigators obviously went to her apartment. She left behind valuables like her passport, plane tickets for an upcoming trip to Oregon, her computer. Investigators interviewed more than 158 people during the investigation, and not a single lead turned up. Anisha was pretty much loved by everyone, had no jealous ex-boyfriends, tumultuous relationships, or any sort or kind of sordid past. Then the case went cold. That is, until just last month. Investigators in Homer, Alaska received an anonymous tip that a man by the name of Kirby Calderwood had confessed to them that he had created a torture chamber in the crawl space of an abandoned home and abducted and killed Anisha Murnane. Naturally, that kind of information is, you know, something that police followed up on. So they followed up with a tipster several more times. And the witness told police everything they knew. The witness claimed that Kirby Calderwood had confessed to them that he had made the decision to abduct and kill a victim that night back in October of 2019, that he had spotted Anisha Murnane walking, picked her up in his blue Subaru, and invited her to his home. And Kirby Calderwood and Anisha Murnane knew one another. Kirby Calderwood had done handyman and odd jobs in the residential home that Anisha lived in. So Anisha got into a Subaru and he invited her back to his home. She said yes. Once they arrived, he told her that he had to go inside and grab a phone charger before she could come in and he would let her know. As she came inside, he attacked her. While there, he restrained her, tortured, and raped her for hours, and then finally killed her. He ended up throwing her cell phone into a nearby lake. Kirby Calderwood admitted to the witness that he stole a Timex watch off of Anisha's wrist before dumping her body in a local dumpster. The tipster told investigators that that Timex was on his dresser. At that point, Kirby Calderwood was officially suspect number one. So investigators dug further. Two women who had been in romantic relationships with Kirby stepped forward, and they said that he was frequently violent. They also said that he would frequently rape and threaten them. One of the women said that he had admitted to hurting animals since he was a child and had, quote, dark and twisted fantasies. Then a third woman stepped forward because she actually had an order of protection against Kirby Calderwood. Why? Because he violently raped her. Not only that, but she reported the rape to the U.S. Army. In fact, two women reported their rapes to the U.S. Army, and the U.S. Army did nothing. The house that he took Anisha to? It belonged to the parents of one of his ex-girlfriends. It was totally left behind and abandoned, and he used it at will. Here's the thing. Kirby Calderwood was now living in Ogden, Utah. But investigators learned that he'd actually lived in Homer between 2016 and 2021. And that was that. Ogden, Utah police were able to get numerous search warrants. And on one of the searches of Kirby Calderwood's home, they located the black women's Timex watch that Anisha Murnane wore every single day. In fact, investigators discovered three of them. Anisha's missing persons flyer was also on his dresser. But that's not all they found. They also found multiple knives and a machete with dried blood on them. This past Thursday, Kirby Calderwood was arrested during a traffic stop in Utah. In his truck, police found multiple handguns, which, by the way, were illegal for him to possess in the first place because he had an order of protection out against him, which that was also pretty recent too, as it was just filed this past December. Kirby Calderwood is currently at the Weber County Correctional Facility in Utah, and police say that he is charged with first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and tampering with physical evidence. And based on where the home was located, how remote it was, that he had unfettered access to it, and then a torture chamber literally made out of the crawl space, I'm actually wondering if we are going to hear a bunch of other news coming out of this case as more information becomes available. Men like that typically don't just have a one and done. It's horrible to think of, but as this case starts going down the pipeline and more information comes out, I would not be surprised if we hear of more victims, especially considering how horribly violent he apparently was. And for those of you who live in Alaska or, hey, Canada, or want to visit Homer, a memorial installation of the Loved and Lost Bench, which is a sculpture in memory of Anisha Murnane and missing and murdered persons, is actually going to be installed at the Homer Public Library on June 12th. Like I said, horribly tragic case, but I'm so happy that her parents are finally receiving closure. Simultaneously devastated, but also over the moon that they have at least knowledge of what happened to her. I've been reading a lot of interviews with Anisha's parents over the last couple weeks, and as horrible and tragic as her death was, they are still so happy to have gotten some semblance of closure. As the lead went cold, they tried to keep her name in the media and keep the investigation going, and they just said that they could not stand, direct quote, they couldn't stand not knowing what happened, for better or for worse. But that is it for this episode, guys. Again, I'm Robin. You're listening to We Saw the Devil. Don't forget, you can find us all across social media at We Saw the Devil, website at wesawthedevil.com. And if you're liking the show, loving the show, please check out our Patreon, where you can become part of the team for as little as $3 a month. Until next crime.